You're listening to From the Public Domain, short stories, excerpts, and essays from the public domain. I'm your host, Susie Alphins. Today's selections are How the Widow Won the Deacon by William James Lambton, The Kiss by Kate Chopin, Shopping for Postage Stamps by Carolyn Wells. How the Widow Won the Deacon by William James Lambton. Of course the Widow Stimson never tried to win Deacon Hawkins, nor any other man for that matter. A widow doesn't have to try to win a man. She wins without trying. Still, the Widow Stimson sometimes wondered why the deacon was so blind as to not see how her fine farm adjoining his equally fine place on the outskirts of the town might not be brought under one management with mutual benefit to both parties at interest. Which one that management might become was a matter of future detail. The widow knew how to run a farm successfully, and a large farm is not much more difficult to run than one of half the size. She had also had one husband, and knew something more than running a farm successfully, of all of which the deacon was perfectly well aware, and still he had not been moved by the merging spirit of the age to propose consolidation. This interesting situation was up for discussion at the Wednesday afternoon meeting of the Sister Sewing Society. "For my part," Sister Susan Spicer, wife of the Methodist minister, remarked as she took another tuck in a 14-year-old girl's skirt for a 10-year-old. "For my part, I can't see why Deacon Hawkins and Kate Stimson don't see the error of their ways and depart from them." "I rather guess she has," smiled Sister Poteet, the grocer's better half, who had taken an afternoon off from the store in order to be present. "Or is willing to," added Sister Maria Cartridge, a spinster still possessing faith, hope, and charity, notwithstanding she had been on the waiting list a long time.
"Really now," exclaimed little Sister Green, the doctor's wife, "do you think it is the deacon who needs urging?" "It looks that way to me,"
Sister Poteet did not hesitate to affirm.
"Well, I heard Sister Clark say that she had heard him call her Kitty one night when they were eating ice cream at the Mite Society,"
Sister Candish, the druggist wife, added to the fund of reliable information on hand.
"Kitty, indeed," protested Sister Spicer. "The idea of anybody calling Kate Stimson Kitty. The deacon will talk that way to most any woman, but if she let him say it to her more than once, she must be getting mighty anxious, I think."
"Oh," Sister Candish hastened to explain,
"Sister Clark didn't say she had heard him say it twice."
"Well, I don't think she heard him say it once,"
Sister Spicer asserted with confidence.
"I don't know about that," Sister Poteet argued. "From all I can see and hear, I think Kate Stimson wouldn't object to most anything the deacon would say to her, knowing as she does that he ain't going to say anything he shouldn't say. And isn't saying what he should,"
added Sister Green with a sly snicker, which went around the room softly.
"But as I was saying,"
Sister Spicer began, when Sister Poteet, whose rocker, near the window, commanded a view of the front gate, interrupted with a warning,
"Shh, shh. Why shouldn't I say what I wanted to when?"
Sister Spicer began.
"There she comes now," explained Sister Poteet. "And as I live, the deacon drove her here in his sleigh, and he's waiting while she comes in. I wonder what next?"
And Sister Poteet, in conjunction with the entire society, gasped and held their eager breaths, awaiting the entrance of the subject of conversation. Sister Spicer went to the front door to let her in, and she was greeted with the greatest cordiality by everybody.
"We were just talking about you and wondering why you were so late in coming,"
cried Sister Poteet,
Now, take off your things and make up for lost time. There's a pair of pants over there to be cut down to fit that poor little Snithers boy.
The excitement and curiosity of the society were almost more than could be borne, but never a sister let on that she knew the deacon was at the gate waiting. Indeed, as far as the widow could discover, there was not the slightest indication that anybody had ever heard there was such a person as the deacon in existence. "Oh," she chirruped, in the liveliest of humors, "you will have to excuse me for today. Deacon Hawkins overtook me on the way here, and here said I simply got to go sleigh riding with him. He's waiting out at the gate now."
"Is that so?" exclaimed the society unanimously, and rushed to the window to see if it were really true.
"Well, did you ever?" commented Sister Poteet generally.
"Hardly ever," laughed the widow good-naturedly.
"And I don't want to lose the chance. You know, Deacon Hawkins isn't asking somebody every day to go sleighing with him. I told him I'd go if he would bring me around here to let you know what had become of me. And so he did. Now, goodbye, and I'll be sure to be present at the next meeting. I have to hurry, because he'll get fidgety."
The widow ran away like a lively schoolgirl. All the sisters watched her get into the sleigh with the deacon and resumed the previous discussion with greatly increased interest. But little recked the widow, and less recked the deacon. He had bought a new horse, and he wanted the widow's opinion of it, for the widow Stimson was a competent judge of fine horseflesh. If Deacon Hawkins had one insatiable ambition, it was to own a horse which could fling its heels in the face of the best that Squire Hopkins drove. In his early manhood, the deacon was no deacon by a great deal. But as the years gathered in behind him, he put off most of the frivolities of youth and held now only to the one of driving a fast horse. No other man in the county drove anything faster except Squire Hopkins. And him, the deacon had not been able to throw the dust over. The deacon would get good ones, but somehow never could he find one that the squire didn't get a better. The squire had also, in the early days, beaten the deacon in the race for a certain pretty girl he dreamed about. But the girl and the squire had lived happily ever after, and the deacon, being a philosopher, might have forgotten the squire's superiority had it been manifested in this one regard only, but in horses too, that gravel the deacon. "How much did you give for him?" was the widow's first query, after they had reached a stretch of road that was good going, and the deacon had let him out for a length or two.
"Well, what do you suppose? You're a judge."
"More than I would give, I'll bet a cookie."
"Not if you was as anxious as I am to show Hopkins that he can't drive by everything on the pike."
"I thought you loved a good horse because he was a good horse," said the widow, rather disapprovingly.
"I do, but I could love him a good deal harder if he would stay in front of Hopkins Best."
"Does he know you've got this one?"
"Yes. And he's been blowing around town that he is waiting to pick me up on the road some day and make my $500 look like a pewter quarter."
"So you gave $500 for him, did you?" laughed the widow.
"Is it too much?"
Hesitated the widow, glancing along the graceful lines of the powerful trotter. "I suppose not, if you can beat the squire."
"Right you are," crowed the deacon. "And I'll show him a thing or two in getting over the ground," he added with swelling pride.
"Well, I hope he won't be out looking for you today with me in your sleigh," said the widow, almost apprehensively. "Because, you know, deacon, I have always wanted you to beat Squire Hopkins." The deacon looked at her sharply. There was a softness in her tone that appealed to him, even if she had not expressed such agreeable sentiments. Just what the deacon might have said or done after the impulse had been set going,
must remain unknown, for at the crucial moment, a sound of militant bells, bells of defiance, jangled up behind them, disturbing their personal absorption, and they looked around simultaneously. Behind the bells was the squire in his sleigh, drawn by his fastest stepper, and he was alone, as the deacon was not. The widow weighed 160 pounds net, which is weighing a horse in a race rather more than the law allows. But the deacon never thought of that. Forgetting everything except his cherished ambition, he braced himself for the contest, took a twist hold in the lines, sent a sharp, quick call to his horse, and let him out for all that was in him. The squire followed suit, and the deacon. The road was wide, and the snow was worn down smooth. The track couldn't have been in better condition. The Hopkins colors were not 5 rods behind the Hawkins colors as they got away. For half a mile, it was nip and tuck, the deacon encouraging his horse and the widow encouraging the deacon. And then the squire began creeping up. The deacon's horse was a good one, but he was not accustomed to hauling freight in a race. A half mile of it was as much as he could stand, and he weakened under the strain. Not handicapped, the squire's horse forged ahead, and as his nose pushed up to the dashboard of the deacon's sleigh, that good man groaned in agonized disappointment and bitterness of spirit. The widow was mad all over that Squire Hopkins should take such a mean advantage of his rival. Why didn't he wait till another time when the deacon was alone, as he was? If she had her way, she never would speak to Squire Hopkins again, nor to his wife either. But her resentment was not helping the deacon's horse to win. Slowly, the squire pulled closer to the front. The deacon's horse, realizing what it meant to his master and to him, spurted bravely. But struggle as gamely as he might, the odds were too many for him, and he dropped to the rear. The squire shouted in triumph as he drew past the deacon, and the dejected Hawkins shriveled into a heap on the seat, with only his hands sufficiently alive to hold the lines. He had been beaten again, humiliated before a woman, and that, too, with the best horse that he could hope to put against the ever-conquering squire. Here sank his fondest hopes. Here ended his ambition. From this on, he would drive a mule or an automobile. The fruit of his desire had turned to ashes in his mouth. But no. What of the widow? She realized, if the deacon did not, that she, not the squire's horse, had beaten the deacon's, and she was ready to make what atonement she could. As the squire passed ahead of the deacon, she was stirred by a noble resolve. A deep bed of drifted snow lay close by the side of the road, not far in front. It was soft and safe, and she smiled as she looked at it, as though waiting for her. Without a hint of her purpose, or a sign to disturb the deacon in his final throes, she rose as the sleigh ran near its edge, and with a spring which had many a time sent her lightly from the ground to the bare back of a horse in the meadow, she cleared the robes and lit plump in the drift. The deacon's horse knew before the deacon did that something had happened in his favor and was quick to respond. With his first jump of relief, the deacon suddenly revived. His hopes came fast again. His blood retingled. He gathered himself, and cracking his lines, he shot forward, and 3 minutes later, he had passed the squire as though he were hitched to the fence. For a quarter of a mile, the squire made heroic efforts to recover his vanquished prestige, but effort was useless. And finally concluding that he was practically left standing, he veered off from the main road down a farm lane to find some spot in which to hide the humiliation of his defeat. The deacon, still going at a clipping gait, had one eye over his shoulder, as wary drivers always have on such occasions. And when he saw the squire was off the track, he slowed down and jogged along with the apparent intention of continuing indefinitely. Presently, an idea struck him, and he looked around for the widow. She was not where he had seen her last. Where was she? In the enthusiasm of victory, he had forgotten her. He was so dejected at the moment she had leaped that he did not realize what she had done, and 2 minutes later he was so elated that, shame on him, he did not care. With her, all was lost. Without her, all was won. And the deacon's greatest ambition was to win. But now, with victory perched on his horse collar, success his at last, he thought of the widow, and he did care. He cared so much that he almost threw his horse off his feet by the abrupt turn he gave him, and back down the pike, he flew as if a legion of squires were after him. He did not know what injury she might have sustained. She might have been seriously hurt, if not actually killed. And why? Simply to make it possible for him to win. The deacon shivered as he thought of it, and urged his horse to greater speed. The squire, down the lane, saw him whizzing along, and accepted it profanely, as an exhibition for his especial benefit. The deacon now had forgotten the squire, as he had only so shortly before forgotten the widow. 200 yards from the drift into which she had jumped, there was a turn in the road, where some trees shut off the sight, and the deacon's anxiety increased momentarily until he reached this point. From here he could see ahead, and down there, in the middle of the road, stood the widow, waving her shawl as a banner of triumph, though she could only guess at results. The deacon came on with a rush and pulled up alongside of her in a condition of nervousness he didn't think possible to him.
"Hooray! Hooray!" shouted the widow, tossing her shawl into the air. "You beat him! I know you did! Didn't you? I saw you pulling ahead at the turn yonder. Where is he and his old plug?"
"Oh, bother take him and his horse and the race and everything. Are you hurt?" gasped the deacon, jumping out, but mindful to keep the lines in his hand. "Are you hurt?" he repeated, anxiously, though she looked anything but a hurt woman. "If I am," she chirped cheerily, "I'm not hurt half as bad as I would have been if the squire had beat you, deacon. Now, don't you worry about me. Let's hurry back to town, so the squire won't get another chance, with no place for me to jump." And the deacon? Well, well. With the lines in the crook of his elbow, the deacon held out his arms to the widow. And the sisters at the next meeting of the Sewing Society were unanimously of the opinion that any woman who would risk her life like that for a husband was mighty anxious. The Kiss by Kate Chopin. It was still quite light out of doors, but inside, with the curtains drawn and the smoldering fire sending out a dim, uncertain glow, the room was full of deep shadows. Brantain sat in one of these shadows. It had overtaken him, and he did not mind. The obscurity lent him courage to keep his eyes fastened as ardently as he liked upon the girl who sat in the firelight. She was very handsome, with a certain fine, rich coloring that belongs to the healthy brune type. She was quite composed as she idly stroked the satiny coat of the cat that lay curled in her lap, and she occasionally sent a slow glance into the shadow where her companion sat. They were talking low, of indifferent things which plainly were not the things that occupied their thoughts. She knew that he loved her. A frank, blustering fellow without guile enough to conceal his feelings, and no desire to do so. For 2 weeks past, he had sought her society eagerly and persistently. She was confidently waiting for him to declare himself, and she meant to accept him. The rather insignificant and unattractive Brantain was enormously rich, and she liked and required the entourage which wealth could give her. During one of the pauses between their talk of the last tea and the next reception, the door opened, and a young man entered whom Brantain knew quite well. The girl turned her face toward him. A stride or two brought him to her side, and bending over her chair, before she could suspect his intention, for she did not realize that he had not seen her visitor, he pressed an ardent, lingering kiss upon her lips. Brantine slowly arose. So did the girl arise, but quickly, and the newcomer stood between them, a little amusement and some defiance struggling with the confusion in his face.
"I believe," stammered Brantine. "I see that I have stayed too long. I had no idea, that is, I must wish you goodbye."
He was clutching his hat with both hands, and probably did not perceive that she was extending her hand to him. Her presence of mind had not completely deserted her, but she could not have trusted herself to speak.
"Hang me if I saw him sitting there, Natty. I know it's deuced awkward for you, but I hope you'll forgive me this once, this very first break."
"Why, what's the matter?"
"Don't touch me. Don't come near me,"
she returned angrily.
"What do you mean by entering the house without ringing?"
"I came in with your brother, as I often do," he answered coldly, in self-justification. "We came in the side way. He went upstairs and I came in here, hoping to find you. The explanation is simple enough and ought to satisfy you that the misadventure was unavoidable. But do say that you forgive me, Natalie," he entreated, softening.
"Forgive you? You don't know what you are talking about. Let me pass. It depends upon a good deal whether I ever forgive you."
At that next reception which she and Brantain had been talking about, she approached the young man with a delicious frankness of manner when she saw him there.
"Will you let me speak to you a moment or two, Mr. Brantain?"
she asked, with an engaging but perturbed smile. He seemed extremely unhappy, but when she took his arm and walked away with him, seeking a retired corner, a ray of hope mingled with the almost comical misery of his expression. She was apparently very outspoken.
"Perhaps I should not have sought this interview, Mr. Brantain, but, I have been very uncomfortable, almost miserable since that little encounter the other afternoon, when I thought how you might have misinterpreted it and believed things."
Hope was plainly gaining the ascendancy over misery in Brantain's round, guileless face.
"Of course, I know it is nothing to you, but for my own sake, I do want you to understand that Mr. Harvey is an intimate friend of long standing. Why, we have always been like cousins, like brother and sister, I may say. He is my brother's most intimate associate and often fancies that he is entitled to the same privileges as the family. Oh, I know it is absurd, uncalled for, to tell you this, undignified even."
She was almost weeping.
"But it makes so much difference to me, what you think of me."
Her voice had grown very low and agitated. The misery had all disappeared from Brantain's face.
"Then you do really care what I think, Miss Natalie? May I call you Miss Natalie?"
They turned into a long, dim corridor that was lined on either side with tall, graceful plants. They walked slowly to the very end of it. When they turned to retrace their steps, Brantain's face was radiant and hers was triumphant. Harvey was among the guests at the wedding, and he sought her out in a rare moment when she stood alone.
"Your husband," he said, smiling,
"has sent me over to kiss you." A quick blush suffused her face and round, polished throat.
"I suppose it's natural for a man to feel and act generously on an occasion of this kind. He tells me he doesn't want his marriage to interrupt wholly that pleasant intimacy which has existed between you and me. I don't know what you've been telling him," with an insolent smile, "but he has sent me here to kiss you."
She felt like a chess player who, by the clever handling of his pieces, sees the game taking the course intended. Her eyes were bright and tender with a smile as they glanced up into his, and her lips looked hungry for the kiss which they invited.
"But you know," he went on quietly, "I didn't tell him so.
It would have seemed ungrateful, but I can tell you, I've stopped kissing women. It's dangerous.
Well, she had Brantine and his million left. A person can't have everything in this world, and it was a little unreasonable of her to expect it.
Shopping for Postage Stamps by Carolyn Wells.
You keep stamps, don't you?
Yes, miss. What kind?
Why, I don't know, but I want something that will go well with blue notepaper.
Yes, miss. Do you want letter postage?
Of course. I want to post letters, not chairs or tables.
Where are the letters to?
United States.
Be careful, young man, or I'll report you for rudeness.
I won't tell you where the letter is going. It's private correspondence.
But it is in the United States.
Then you want a 2-cent stamp.
Here you are.
Oh, red ones?
Never.
Do you suppose I'd put that sickly shade of crushed gooseberry juice on my robin's egg blue envelopes? Is this the nearest thing you have in 2-cent stamps?
The very latest style, I assure you.
Well, they won't do. Why, they aren't fit for anything unless to make a stamp plate with. Haven't you any blue ones?
Yes, we have a nice line of blue ones at 5 cents each.
Oh, the price doesn't matter. Let me see them, please.
Here they are. Beautiful shade of blue.
Good enough shade, but it doesn't quite harmonize with my envelopes. You see, they are a sort of greenishy blue, and your stamps are more indigo-ish. Do you expect any new ones in?
Well, not any different colors.
Oh, dear, that's always the way. But maybe I could take some of these and dye them with my Easter egg dyes to match my paper. I did that with some lace, and it worked awfully well. What's the lightest color you have?
These pale green ones are as light as any, but if you dye them blue, you can't use them.
Why not?
The government won't allow it.
How mean! As if it made any difference to them what color stationery people use. It almost makes me want to be a suffragette when I hear of such tyranny. Not that I'd really be one. I'm too fearfully afraid of a mouse. But I'd like to have a few rights about postage stamps. I do think the selection is very limited. There's more beauty and variety in cigar bands. Well, I'll look at these violet ones. How much are they?
These are 3 cents apiece.
2 for 5 cents, I suppose. Well, I could get violet notepaper and use violet ink. Then these stamps would do nicely.
And they'd match your eyes fairly well, too.
Isn't that queer? Everybody says I have violet eyes, but really? They're not a bit the color of these stamps, you know.
No. Look at me and let me see. Well, no, they're not exactly the same shade, but they're violet eyes, all right. How many stamps will you have?
2, please. But won't you give them to me out of the middle of the sheet? Those around the edge seem a little faded.
We can't tear stamps out of the middle of a sheet.
Oh, yes, you can if you try. If I ask you to try. I'll take that one and that one.
Well, I suppose it doesn't matter. This one, did you say? And this one?
Yes, please. Will you wrap them up in a neat parcel and send them?
Good morning. You've been listening to From the Public Domain. Today's selections were read by Susie Alphons. This is your host, Susie Alphons.